I'm your host, Tom Wilmer, reporting from the studios at KCBX, NPR affiliate in San Luis Obispo, California. Come along and join me for a conversation with two seminal architects and architectural historian. Victoria, go ahead and introduce yourself and Quincy.
My name is Victoria Newhouse. I'm an architectural historian, and I'm a co-editor of the book that we're going to be discussing today, Housing the Nation.
And this is Quincy Williams, managing project architect at Alexander Gorling Architects here in NYC, representing Alexander Gorling at this discussion.
We're here today to talk about a new book, Housing the Nation, Social Equity, Architecture, and the Future of Affordable Housing. Victoria, start out, talk to us a little bit about backstory, how the book came to be and what you hope to communicate.
Well, Alex Gorling, who is the co-editor of the book with me, and I were invited to write an article for Oculus Magazine, which is a publication for architectural professionals, on affordable housing. This is 3 years ago. The issue had already begun to be talked about extensively in the popular press. We wrote the article, and after some research and thought about the subject, it occurred to us that a book on the subject, which would expand on some of the issues that we discussed in the article, could perhaps reach people, well, the general public for general information, but also people who we hoped might make a difference and help improve this very critical situation.
I think this book could serve as a handbook for anybody involved in the professional housing world.
That's what we had hoped for.
And additionally, what a great textbook for a postgraduate program, because you guys came up with an encyclopedic coverage of the subject.
Well, that's wonderful to hear, because we had hoped to broaden the general perception of the subject. We felt that most people knew very little, if anything, about it. And so that was actually one of our goals.
Well, you did a great job, home run. I've read the book three times, and I'm still trying to just digest the basics. It is so packed with information and history. For example, I would love to have you go back in time, because to understand today, you have to understand the roots of public housing. Talk for a moment about back 100 years ago, tenements in New York City and failed public housing projects in Chicago, etc.
Good. Well, I hope that Quincy will help me fill in some of the facts. Actually, public housing started seriously in the United States in 1937 as part of the New Deal. It was made possible by limited equity and co-ops, and it was segregated, as it remained so for decades, and in fact still is in many places.
Reading your book, one of the causes of the failure of public housing and housing projects was the absence of adequate funding for maintenance and security, etc.
Yes, well, NYCHA, which is the organization who is in control of public housing in New York City, has billions of dollars of debt in deferred maintenance. It has been a tremendous problem. And in fact, that group came to the realization a couple of years ago that they simply could not cover maintenance. They couldn't build and take care of maintenance. And they started then. I really haven't checked this, but it's my understanding. We were told a couple of years ago that they were starting to hire private maintenance corporations to make sure that what they built would hold up and be taken care of.
In fact, so through the RAD renovation process, NYCHA began pooling a series of for-profit developers to assist them in renovating their large dilapidated infrastructures. And it seems to be to the success of the city that this is seemingly working aside of the federal blockades that they've had in funding over the years for maintenance of their housing stock.
Interesting. This may be neither here nor there, but I was fascinated by a section where you talked about Nutra and Alexander's plans for Chavez Ravine in Los Angeles in the late 50s. and how that was ultimately sabotage, even though it was a grand vision.
Yes, well, that is one of the more embarrassing or regretful incidents in the history of public housing, where the local government came up with a very, very nice plan for this particular area of Los Angeles, which was populated primarily by Mexican immigrants. Not luxurious housing by any means, but it was comfortable and it worked for the people who lived there. And the mayor at that time felt that it could be improved and also expanded. However, a gentleman who is quite famous, who owned the Los Angeles Times, Norman Chandler, was violently opposed to that. He was he was a conservative. He was against unions. He was against social welfare, including affordable housing. And he just put a damper on the whole thing. I mean, he managed with his rich and powerful friends to just shut the whole idea down, and it never got built.
In the early days of the Chavez Ravine project, they came in and bulldozed minority, low-income housing, and that's something we've seen across the country, especially during 60s and 70s, quote, urban renewal. I spent time recently in Tulsa's Greenwood District, and they were showing me how the interstate blasted right through the heart of the neighborhood. I was in Cincinnati a few weeks ago, and they were showing me how the West End minority neighborhood was decimated by urban renewal, bringing in the interstate right through the center of the neighborhood.
Yes, well, that's happened in many cities. I'm not familiar with what happened in those particular cities, but I am familiar with Austin because I wrote recently about a new park there. And there, the connection between the downtown, the very, very prosperous downtown, and the much poorer east side of the city was completely destroyed by a federal highway, I-35, which came through in the 1960s.
Let's talk about, you had alluded to systemic racism as a barrier to affordable housing.
Yes, it is. And there are several objects in the book on the subject. One of our contributors, David Trout, is an African American. He teaches law. He's a lawyer. He teaches law at Rutgers. He has described in the book in great detail of what's happening in Newark, New Jersey, how big-time development groups come in and buy up housing at very, very low rates from people in the African American community, and then just simply hitch up the prices for the same real estate.
Interesting. And that being said, you talk about the unaffordability of home ownership due to the exponential rise in property values, compounded by minimum wage not keeping pace. That's a huge deal breaker.
Yes, it is. Well, we have several economists in the book. I think they all agree that there is just too much of a difference in between the haves and the have-not in the United States today, probably in other countries too, but we're certainly very much aware of it here.
And you noted, a couple of your economists noted, that a fair minimum wage today would be between $23 and $26 per hour.
That's right, yes.
You know, the other thing that your book made me think about is you talk about a barrier to entry for any project is the exorbitant cost of land. And I spent some time a while ago in Hong Kong, and I went over to the New Territories. And they had just built a new, like, 30-plus story tall high-rise apartment building, and they had within it a shopping center, grocery store, medical care, and everything. And I thought, you know, what a brilliant solution to land use. Talk about that as an alternative.
Well, neither Quincy or I were familiar with that Hong Kong project, but it sounds like a great idea. Kimmelman wrote recently in the New York Times about another interesting idea, which is to combine the construction of affordable housing with the design and construction of a public library. I mean, people always want a library in their neighborhood. They don't always want affordable housing. So isn't it an interesting idea to put the two together?
Right. And in fact, so part of NYCHA's earlier mandate was to infuse affordable housing with different community services, whether it's daycares or some form of medical service on facility, taking from the mold that was developed in Europe in the early 20s. But I believe those quickly got phased out, and seemingly so in this time, it seems some of these facilities are slowly making their way back into the affordable housing sectors. We start to develop modern affordable housing.
You noted a housing project for homeless in Los Angeles, an apartment complex that was very forward-thinking, and it, reading in the book, it sounds like a very successful project.
Some of the projects Quincy has worked on, in fact, include a number of services. Do you want to talk about that, Quincy?
So over the last few years, we've developed some projects, for instance, here in New York City for communal life, in which not only did we develop housing, but we developed community services around community art galleries so that neighborhood residents can have a destination, can have an outlet. What we've been finding over the past couple of years, whether with, for instance, art galleries or the infusion of an ambulatory diagnostic center within our residential buildings or some sort of community service, is that it helps the local community, but it also helps the residents to have these facilities on site. For instance, I mentioned just a few moments ago about a daycare center. These used to be things of old, and what we've been finding now is as HPD are bringing on new RFPs for housing in varying neighborhoods, as part of the community visioning report, the residents of the local communities are asking for some of these facilities to be embedded within the residential complex. And I think it bears importance. For one, childcare. We've seen through the pandemic that we had very large issues with childcare, and if we can have those within the residence, I think it helps that sector of our population.
Going forward, creating a holistic community where all your basic needs are there might hopefully eliminate the need for having a car or even public transportation, a walkable village.
We totally agree with that. These, again, coming back to these ideas of walkable communities, the convenience of that, and rightfully so, the environmental impact that will have is tremendous. As you know, we talk about climate change. The car has been one of those vehicles, and the emissions, one of those vehicles that has fueled the climate issues that we have of today. Well, rightfully said, coming back to these communities, whether it's on a residential complex within a larger residential construct, I think will help multiple facets of our society.
Going back in time, you alluded earlier to 100 years ago. In your book, you talk about community housing dating from the 1920s in Vienna, Austria, that was very successful. Then you also note social housing in the Netherlands. It appears that they have been more evolved than us for decades.
Well, the big difference is, of course, that in those countries, the federal government subsidizes affordable housing. They started early, and so they've built up a whole system that still is very functional.
Very fascinating.
And I guess to add to that also is, rightfully said, as Victoria's mentioned, the government has played a key role in housing, let's say housing the nation, for lack of better words. But the housing, even though it's been kept to this day, it is not just for the unfortunate sector of society. It serves multifacets of society, young professionals, students, those who are impoverished as well. So it creates these very vibrant mixed communities. And that, I think, in terms of its mold, has been very successful in keeping it that way. In addition to that, there's another point that comes out in it also, by keeping these rents at a certain level and keeping this government social institution, it has also helped to create competition in the public sector. So public sector rents don't seem to be egregious in comparison to what we see here in our sectors.
Yeah, I'd like to actually add one detail there to what Quincy just said, which is that a very, very important aspect of the social housing in both Austria and the Netherlands is that it remains under the control of the government, and it never goes back into the market.
Could that happen here?
I don't know. What do you think, Quincy?
I think it's a possibility. I mean, we've had, based on legislation, issues with such. I think coming out of the 1970s, in which the Section 8 vouchers, when a government was shifting from Section 236 into Section 8 and so on, they allowed for certain subsidies to go into the sector. But then at some point, after a period of 15 years or after a period of the mortgage, the units could then turn themselves back over into the private sector. And I think that really hurts us. You know, if our intention really is to focus on the needs of our people and really help our society, then we should look at the mold of Vienna and the Netherlands and keep the units for perpetuity within the public sector.
You know, that being said, you make me think of SROs, single room occupancies, which, for example, out in the West Coast here, San Francisco and Los Angeles has had for 100 years. I was with the Society of St. Vincent de Paul in Skid Row in Los Angeles, and we looked up at this cool old high-rise, and it was an SRO. And he goes, well, somebody's buying it. They're converting it to upscale suites. And that's one of our problems, is that we have some of this housing, which we then destroy and take out.
Yeah, that's true.
It's a problem indeed. And, you know, I think stemming from the age in which we were rebuilding and or we were building our nation, these SROs provided for housing for the workforce. And it would be a great thing to preserve as much of those because, for instance, our large, unhoused, young student population needs places to stay. And their families, whether it's a single adult or a young family, a young couple, could well benefit from an SRO unit. And I tend to believe it. Most of those should have been preserved wherever we could.
And going forward, doesn't it make logical sense that we ought to put an emphasis on creating new SROs?
That is in conversation, I believe.
Let's talk about co-living in Section 8 housing for a moment.
I think, Quincy, you know more about that than I do.
Section 8, I think, for all its pluses and minuses, has an enormous benefit if we take a step back, in which vouchers were giving out so that affordable housing could be built. And I think this comes back to your prior question in terms of keeping housing affordable for perpetuity, very similar to the Vienna or the Netherlands model. And I believe Robert Kuntner speaks in depth about this in his essay, as well as Marjorie Perlmutter, I think, and Rosen Haggerty. Section 8 being what it is, I think, has become a problem in the current state as it is. For instance, there are a lot of Section 8 vouchers that remain unfulfilled in the nation as of today, and probably will be remained unfilled for families to hold these vouchers.
What's the barrier?
I think the barrier simply is in the private sector, landlords not wanting to deal with Section 8 as it is, because these tenants, potential tenants, they go out into the private market looking for residents. And I think in this day and age where there's enough capital going around, and there's a sector of a society that can rent for upwards of $4,000 a month for a studio apartment here in the city. As a landlord, why get into the hassle of renting with someone with a Section 8 voucher?
Interesting.
I believe that, you know, government should get involved in building affordable housing, building housing for those who are unhoused and who need them. And hopefully in doing so, we can and keep a house in stock. We can hopefully move residents from temporary housing into permanent housing in some designed fashion. But I think it's a long conversation. And we've been having these conversations for the past number of decades. But hopefully we can move this needle forward.
Quincy, if you don't mind, talk to us a little bit about new housing project that you ramrodded in the Bronx. The Borinquen Residences?
El Borinquen.
Yeah, and talk to us about challenges and solutions that you instilled into that project.
I guess I can say good things. In terms of stumbling blocks, we had a few, but those were really in the early stages of planning and getting to the sign-in table. These projects, as you may know, take about 3 years, if not four, to come to fruition. And in the early stages of it, the design process, dealing with the local government to get their approvals, to get units streamlined, and for our client and developer really to streamline their finances and capital stacks, whether coming from here or local HPD or the HCR or other funding streams, really getting those together and having all the players speaking the same language by the time we get to the end of the design process. I think those are the major hurdles of getting there and fulfilling the varying design standards and governmental requirements of the varying agencies would be where the congestions comes. But I think once we get past those hurdles, for instance, with the El Borinquen project, it was a relatively smooth sail for this 148 unit development. The land and so on was available at the time that the client needed it. We were able to find a great contractor to help us as a partner to put this together. And as mentioned, we came up with a great community use in the base of the building that not only serves the residents, but also pulls in some community attraction. And it's become a vibrant hub for artists in the building, as well as local artists coming in to display and uplift the lives of the residents.
Are these fee simple ownership, or are they rental units within the project?
These are rental units within the project that are geared to a series of clientele. Whether it's youth in the Life is Precious program that El Borinquen runs under the auspices of Dr. Gill and her great leadership team. And then there's general population units, which are also rental units, but it's a cross-section of rentals.
And Quincy, you forgot to mention the most important thing is that you got first prize, I think, for that building actually this year from given by a group. You could remind me who awarded it.
Yeah, thanks for mentioning that. I actually forgot about that for a second. So we got two great awards. One was coming from New York State for the best project in Downstate for the year 2023. And in addition to that, we just won an AIA National Award for housing, for social housing, which was great.
Is it a nonprofit organization that oversees it? How does that work financially?
It's definitely a non-for-profit developer, Communal Life. And their financials of how they organize this and so on, I'm not too clear of the particulars. But just overhearing over the last number of years, whatever subsidies they do get from the rental assistance programs and so on, the rest, which is backed from their government partners, they will use those to run, manage, and facilitate the building themselves for the life of them. But they are dependent on the rental subsidies. That's either part, some of these are part of Section 8 and some of these are part of other governmental programs.
Going forward, will this serve as a model for future projects?
Going forward, I think there's a number of great models. I think our project is a landmark and a node within this community. I think what we have done could be a model for a number of projects going forward. And we hope to use this as a tool to envision more creative ways of providing affordable housing coupled with community services that can enrich the lives of the residents and the community around.
In your book, you talk about Alabama's Front Porch and Rural Studio and how they engage architecture students and nonprofit builders such as Habitat for Humanity to create truly affordable housing. Talk to us a bit about that model.
Well, it's interesting. Alex Gorlin, my co-editor, and I were both quite surprised to learn that rural communities across the country have the same problem with finding a place to live as city dwellers do. And we were really very much impressed by this group. I think one of the things that makes it so successful is that, first of all, they're very skillful in finding less expensive materials with which to build, less expensive designs to build. But also, I think tremendously important is their collaboration with other similar groups across the country, especially in the South. So they exchange experiences and information, which is something that actually leads me to talk about another essay in the book. Actually, Quincy mentioned Roseanne Haggerty, who is very involved with systems and systems analysis. And she has worked for many decades with the homeless very successfully. In fact, she created the first affordable housing dwelling in a hotel in Times Square some years ago, I think as much as 20 years ago. But her theory is that one of the reasons that we're in this crisis now is what she calls systems breakdown, that there's not enough of the collaboration like we see in Alabama, for example, among different architects and builders and contractors and so forth. And to be successful at this complex project, and you yourself mentioned how for that to work, for all of those different groups that are involved in one of these projects to actually succeed, they have to communicate and collaborate with each other.
Out here on the West Coast, auxiliary dwelling units, commonly referred to as ADUs, have become very popular, even garnering a moniker among advocates, YIMBYs, for Yes in My Backyard.
What do you think, Quincy?
Not just yet. I think the current mayoral administration is tinkering and working on varying potential policies to shift in that gear. We've sat in on a few discussions in which they've presented the idea of ADUs a lot in the lower density residential neighborhoods, which I think could be a very great idea given where we are in this crisis. So it's yet to be seen. I think some of these legislative agendas are set for the end of this year, and we'll wait to see what comes of it. But to take a quick step back and just to add one note on the question of rural studio as well, I think what was interesting also about the group is that the architecture students come together and they help to build residence for those who lack thereof. And for a decent enough cost, because they're able to keep that cost relatively low. But there's another program that could or should be meshed with this. For instance, the U.S. Department of Energy a number of years ago had started a program called the Solar Decathlon, in which they had engaged universities across the U.S., and I think now they're pushing into Europe and so on, to bring students together to build efficient and affordable residential constructs. And I think as a mold for these competitions, over 40 universities across the U.S. or more at this point, it's a good mold to have the young architectural students not only engage in housing, but engage in affordable housing that's also sustainable. And these homes that hopefully, currently I think the idea at some point is they construct them, they get critiqued, and they're either dismantled or left somewhere else. But these can be donated to varying communities across the U.S. or in some places. Probably these competitions are allowed to develop a series of homes that are left in X state per year or something. But I think it's something else that can lend itself to that environment.
And I know another dynamic of keeping costs under control. They loop in the homeowner to spend time actually helping to build the structure.
Get engaged, you know, the habitat mold, and why not? You know, we have students coming out on summer breaks. Why not get them involved in building projects as a community engagement during the summers? We no longer do the harvest, but probably we can do housing.
Exactly. Another topic that you guys touch on in the book is trailers, manufactured homes. It's noted in the book that a cost per square foot for a trailer is $85 a square foot versus an average of $250 a square foot for a conventional home. So that seemed like a real viable way to go relative to cost.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it seems like a brilliant idea. I think it's valid only in areas with a certain kind of climate, because I think, you know, excessive winds like we're getting with climate change might be a problem. But I think for certain environments, yes. And there are other solutions that have come up. There's a project in Mexico, in the countryside, that has been built with 3D printers. Unbelievably enough, I mean, we're all used to demonstrations of objects that can be built with a 3D printer, but the idea that an actual house could be built that way is quite intriguing.
And a thematic thread throughout your book has to do with homelessness, and then it has / economics and the cost of whatever. Going forward, those seem to be major challenges.
Yeah, well, I mean, what nobody seems to focus on is that it is much more expensive to try and take care of homeless people who very often develop alcoholism and drug abuse as a result of their homelessness. It's much more expensive for the government to take care of those people than it would be if they simply built decent housing for them.
Victoria, when you started the book, what did you hope to accomplish, if nothing else, in communicating?
Well, we hoped to get the interest of people like you, Tom. And I must say, we've had an enormous amount of attention paid to the book. In the 3 months since it was published, we've had almost 60 interviews and reviews. And we're hoping that among all of those people who are interested in the book, that it will find its way into the hands of certain government people or nonprofit organizations, church groups, etc., who might profit by the book. You were very complimentary when we began our conversation today about the uses the book could be put to. And that's just what our hope is, that it will be put to that kind of use.
Yeah, I see a classic textbook, a handbook for people in that quarter of study.
Yes, that's what we hope for.
Yeah, it's just so holistic in its overarching approach. So what have I not asked that you'd like to share?
Quincy, what do you think?
That's a good question. I think we would like to share is, which could never be overstressed, the urgent need for more housing. Look, I would take this a step back. We've, funny enough, though funny I say, not to overstress that, we've been at this crisis, this problem, since the onsets of the 1920s. And here we are in 2024, and we haven't been able to solve or closely eradicate this problem. Someone wrote that, you know, we've been able to solve issues of pandemics, smallpox. We've been able to, on larger levels, come together and solve the issues of even COVID-19 collectively, not just here in our country. So I tend to think we need to seriously sit down on a policy level, on all levels, even on the elementary level, teach this in school, the need for housing, the need for coming together and being creative about how we try to, as a collective, as a people, solve this problem once and for all.
You know, this is a very amorphous comment, and I don't know if there's any easy way to answer, but I spend a lot of time in the San Francisco Bay Area, Silicon Valley, San Francisco, Oakland, and it's just shocking and stunning the extent of homelessness, and then / one of the most wealthy areas of the world. I mean, there's so many multimillionaires there, and I'm going, you guys can't come up with a program to fix this? It says something about a disconnect in our culture and our society, because the very people that can have that compassion and conversation to talk about it is one thing. To do something is a total another.
Yes, That's quite true. Yeah, I talked just before this program with the only commercial developer who has a chapter in the book, and Alex and I wanted to include such a person to get that point of view. And he rattled off half a dozen different things that could be done about financing that would allow developers to go ahead with more affordable housing. I mean, nobody expects a for-profit developer to take a loss on something they're building. There always has to be some sort of a subsidy because it costs as much to build most affordable housing as it does to build market-rate housing. But here's a man who is involved commercially, who sees, you know, unlimited possibilities with a little help financially from different financial institutions, from private investors who are now beginning to be interested in investing to a certain extent in risk-adjusted equity, even for a smaller return, and so on. So, you know, there's a lot of goodwill out there. I think, you know, I come back again to the argument about putting it all together in a system that works.
In your book, you talk about housing projects where part of the city or county will require, say, 20-30% to be low income, and which the developers do, and they get tax incentives for it. But then you alluded in a couple places where then down the road they reach some point and they're able to take them out of that.
Yeah, I think we touched on that very briefly earlier, the fact that several of our authors have emphasized the need to keep this affordable housing affordable and not to, and just to avoid what you've just mentioned.
Very overwhelming topic. How long did it take you to write that book?
Well, let's see. It took us about 2 years of research and a year don't forget it. I mean, we didn't do the writing. It was all of our 18 authors who did the writing. So, and the essays are relatively short. I think they're 1,000 words each. Just a year to write, 2 years to research.
Okay. Well, anything you guys want to add? Anything you're thinking of before we go?
Quincy, do you have anything?
I guess I'll end with one quote, I guess, comes out from one of the essays, and this was by Philip Thompson. And he was quoting Dr. King in a portion of his, and he was saying, "It is a constitutional right for man to be able to vote in quite a year, but the human right to a decent house is a categorically imperative and morally absolute." And I think that is and was a powerful statement. And I think we should, on my end, that's where I would leave this conversation.
Yeah, I don't think I can improve on that.
Very well said. Okay, before we go, Quincy and Victoria, to learn more about your world.
I guess we would say Housing the Nation, Social Equity Architecture and the Future of Affordable Housing. Do find this in the bookstores at the Rizzoli Bookstore as well as throughout the nation. And for the work that we do in terms of our office, do find us at alexandergorlinarchitects.com.
And Quincy, do you have a LinkedIn or website to go to?
alexandergorlinarchitects.com. You can find us there. I am on LinkedIn as well as Alex and Victoria.
And Victoria, to learn more about your world?
Well, this is my 7th book. So anybody who's interested in what I've done before, I've written mostly about cultural institutions. Recently about repurposing land that has been used industrially, repurposing it for cultural events. And so anybody interested in that can Google me and you'll see all my books listed.
That's the one about parks around the world, right?
That's right.
Yeah, I love that book.
Oh, thank you. I think you interviewed me about it, actually.
I did. We did by phone.
Yes, right.
Saved us 3,000-mile trip. Well, Victoria and Quincy, thank you guys so very much. This has been fascinating.
Thank you, Tom, for your interest.
Thank you for having us.
You're welcome. I'm your host, Tom Wilmer, reporting from the West Coast from the studios at KCBX NPR affiliate in San Luis Obispo, California.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas Award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, iTunes, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world. To learn more about Tom Wilmer's journeys around America and the world, log on to thomaswilmer.com.
This is Roseanne Cash, and I'm sitting here with Tom Wilmer. Please support your local NPR station. I listen to WNYC in New York. In fact, NPR is all I listen to. If I didn't have NPR, I would feel like my lifeline to the world has been cut. So, yes, please support your local NPR station.